You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Lida Cempolin. Lida, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hello, Brainerd. Congratulations on your good work with Yale University Radio, and thank you for including me in your program.
Oh, thank you, Lida. Let's talk about what you're working on now. What is the project that you're currently involved in? I know a little bit about it, but to explain to the viewers, can you tell us what you're working on now?
Okay, sure. Well, I just completed an article, which is a partial, let's say, view of what I'm working on. It's a partial snapshot. The article is on Swiss artist Daniel Sperry, and it's about the Edición Matt, and that's published in Nerica, the Revista de Studio de Arte in Mexico. That has been just completed in June, and it's part of a larger work of a monograph. So, what I'm doing is basically I'm reviewing the work of this artist, of this Swiss artist. He's extremely famous in Europe, and let's say he's been publishing, exhibiting all over Europe for more than 55 years. And you certainly remember that he's famous for the trap pictures or snare pictures or tableau piège in France. It's where he debuted in the art world in 1960. However, let's say that his real debut, and that's what I reconstructed with the Edition Mat, his real debut happened in 1959, and not as an artist, but as an editor. And that really captured my attention. While I was researching the artist, I found out that he was, first of all, he had a career as a dancer, which is quite phenomenal, and a career, a big career. He was assistant to Sellner in Bern in Switzerland for theater, and then he was also a poet. So that is all. Those are quite extraordinary ingredients.
That is extraordinary.
Yeah, right. So he was not an artist, and he's first and foremost of an artist, right? He's quite famous, but he did not start as an artist. So my article tried to look at the key year of 1959, when the Edition Mat were born. And Edition Mat means two things. One is the short form for Material. And Material was basically a series of anthologies of concrete poetry, of experimental poetry, that started around 1958 and through the 59, and there were Fluxus artists involved in that as well. And then we have the second portion, the second meaning of the word Edition Mat means in French multiplication d'art transformable, basically multiplication of transformable art. So putting together these things, I found out that was quite interesting. Well, multiples have always happened. Multiplication has happened in sculpture. You think of Rodin, right? And multiplication of bronze sculptures, cast process, and a process of multiplication in printmaking and many other means in photography. But this is the first time in the late modernism in which the idea of multiplication of sculpture is connected to the idea of movement. So we basically have a three-dimensional sculpture living in space. This sculpture through a movement that can be done by, let's say, by optically, by the audience just moving, or through the intervention of a motor that is it's included in the work, or through the people themselves, the audience, manipulating with their hands the work. In any case, the movement allows basically the piece to change configuration within the continuity of the structure. Which means if you have 100 pieces in an edition, that's what it was setting for, each of the pieces will be originals because each of them will be presenting a different gestalt, but all of them have the same, basically different configurations of the same mass. So that's quite an interesting fact. And in order to understand that deeply, I had to dig into the idea of edition and see what was going on. Lots of Fluxus edition, before Fluxus even, and Gerstner was working editions too, and all the concrete poets were working in edition, this material. So that was happening in the late 50s. So basically, the idea is this, of continuity of structure and changing gestalt. What happened in an edition of two-dimensional work, for instance, in design? You have a logo, you want the evolution of the logo. Each time you make a modification, you need to make a new print, a new two-dimensional print. Instead, the sculpture is movable in space, is even if you have 100 copies, you can have them basically look differently. So that's something that interests me. And I was starting to look at the bigger picture. We talk about dance, we talk about theater, we talk about concrete poetry, but then there is Fluxus Artist before Fluxus, because Spöri met Dieter Roth, Robert Filiou, Emmett Williams in the late 50s, second half of the 50s, before you will hear about Fluxus in 62 with Matsunas. And then you have Duchamp, whose fame was resurrected around that time, around the late 50s. And then you have the op artist. Yes?
Well, you also mentioned that, and correct me if I'm wrong, because, yeah, this is very interesting, that history right in there. You mentioned he was also, the artist was also editing volumes of concrete poetry.
Yes.
And that was just before Fluxus, right? So we're talking about all those things kind of coming together.
Yes.
At about the same time?
Yeah, yes, exactly. We're talking about the material, we're talking about 58, 59. Those are crucial years for material, for the concrete poetry, for these editions. Also, Karl Gerstner was becoming more and more in Werk, in a magazine. He's a Swiss designer. He was involved in this and becoming really famous. He put an agency in 59. So he was quite notorious in Switzerland around the time of 59, and he became a collaborator. That's also interesting with Spöri. First, he provided some artwork of his own, and then he will become the editor, co-editor with Daniel Spöri in 1964-65, when the Edition Mat will be revived, and there will be new groups and generations of artists participating. So the picture is extremely complex, and you cannot understand Spöri if you don't stretch yourself beyond the sculptor and the sculpture. You really have to look at what was happening at the time in other areas. So look at design, graphic design, Gerstner, you have to look at poetry, you have to look at the Fluxus, where these artists were already active, right, before the Fluxus boxes of the 60s. So you have all these things to look into. And obviously the Nouveau Realist coming as well, but a year later in 60, so being involved later in 64, 65. And this also made me understand that Spöri, there was another interesting part. Spöri is known as Nouveau Realist, but Spöri was also a Fluxus artist. And I interviewed him on August 10, 2013, in Seggiano in Italy, where he has a sculpture garden. And he basically said, well, these are all boxes, right, of history, but I really feel like I was Fluxus, right? I belong to Fluxus. But, you know, they put you in the Nouveau Realist box, and they're basically locating there. They're not locating you with Fluxus. Those were happening at the same time. Spöri was Fluxus and Nouveau Realist at the same time.
Well, this is very interesting, and also a part of, you know, how you're reevaluating and re-understanding history, right, as you write this. Now
yes.
That we see so much context, which I certainly didn't know, you know, all the things that he was involved in and doing, that even, you know, how we perceive his practice has,
yes.
You know, potentially changed if everybody reads your book and takes it to heart. But history, in a way, can really influence how we view an artist's oeuvre or their entire output, right? As he's saying, these are boxes, historical boxes.
Yes.
But that tends to be what we do, right?
Yes, absolutely. It's necessary to put some order, right, in things, to give some sense. But that's what he, let's call, demystifies, right, what is clarified and produced for us. I will tell you something that it was also very interesting to me about him. There is a book that he wrote, and this is becoming more and more known in 2013. Kyra Cabanas wrote a book about the Nouveau Realism, and she focused specifically on the topography. Anecdotal Topography of Chance is a book that Spöri wrote in 62 and in France, and then he published in the Fluxus edition with Something Else Press in New York in 1966. And that book is interesting because basically it's a mapping of a table that was in a specific day of and a specific hour of 1961, a blue table that Spöri had in his room in the Hotel Carcassonne. And he basically froze that on time and started describing each item in that table. There is even a map, a two-dimensional map at the beginning of the call, behind the cover jacket. And you basically see that he provides short description of each item. So it says, this is a bottle that was given to me in this. And then it's really heavily notated, like a scholar will do, right, with some very deep information about the brand of the bottle or a very important personal story, very in detail, that has also some art making of what he was doing in the art world at the time. So there is a lot of art history behind this book, But the first time I read it a few years ago, I couldn't understand anything. And the reason is because the narrative that describes the item, those are numbered, those narratives are so vague. They don't have even a date or anything. They mention, exhibitions he was involved to or things he was doing, but you don't have dates. And so the interesting part is there are missing links as well. And it's a game for art historians. The more you study, the more, and I was reading that this summer, everything made a lot more sense now. So let's make an example. There is one bottle, number 62, that is described as the bottle on which he was basically tied a bow that his friend Kicha gave him to wear at the for the exhibition The Art of Assemblage in New York. Now, it's all finished here, but there's nothing else in there. But if you know that in the Art of Assemblage exhibition at the moment, 61, there was the exhibition that really consecrated Spöri fame in the art world. And there he had the Nouveau Realiste, right, the work, the trap picture. His piece that was purchased and made him famous all over the world was Kicha Breakfast. So he's basically, in that narration, there is a link that is missing, the Kicha Breakfast. But Kicha was having breakfast in his room at the Hotel Carcassonne. And there are pieces of, shells of eggs there in the table. He's describing them as well. He's giving clues of this lady, but then there is an exhibition happening in the United States where, by the way, at the time he was not able to attend. He did not have money, he said. So you have basically two places, Paris and New York, they're connected, but there is not a specific date. Those dates, those are happening different times. The Art of Assemblage in 61, the book in Paris in 62, but without the dates, it's the eternal present. So he's basically missing links so that you can fill it in, like playing the art history game, and also he's creating the idea of a network that is like the eternal present, as Castells says in his book in 1996, so we're talking about many years later, the rise of the network society, right? He is putting together the eternal present. So it's extremely interesting, the process that he works on, and he's doing poetry of art history. Because what you have in poetry is basically you have a sentence, right, of your life, and then you select a couple of words, two, three words, they are part of the sentence, you eliminate everything else. And people have to create connections with their fantasy between those words. Those words will mean to you something. Those words will mean, as a poet, those words will mean to other people something else because they haven't read your narrative. So that's what he's doing with topography.
Oh, well, that's a very interesting way to see
absolutely.
The art history, and I love that because it's like a game, a poetic game. But but that's very interesting because if we're all bringing our own kind of thoughts, agenda, way of thinking, like if I read a poem about the death of a child or mother, you would experience it very differently and have your own associations. How much does that really color history? Then we have to constantly rewrite history for knowing how historians had certain biases because of what they were going through at the time, right?
Yes, and think about, absolutely, it's absolutely right. And think about, even art history, I would like to, and I always did in my work, I sort of demystify it, right? I sort of challenge it. I challenge boundary of art history. Think about that. Is art history completely objective? It's basically, it's like being a trial, right? You basically present a case. So you collect the evidence and you present a case. Can you know everything that ever happened? No. So you're basically, the more you know, obviously, the more the picture will be complete or will look more complete, right? And the case will be made. The same with archaeology. You have artifacts and you don't know really, you cannot know for sure what happened. You have a great amount of very intelligent speculation about what the object were for. Certainly you're close to the truth, but you cannot have the absolute truth because there will be a new artifact coming later and it might be contradicting what you were thinking before. But it's this constant process of thinking, evolving, which is also what he was doing in his thought about art, is the constant evolving and questioning. That is what we do as professors, what students do as students, right? And what we have to humbly be able to always do, right? Is think about and evolve.
So that's very interesting because it's history is always subject. I mean, that makes me think also there are artists, contemporary artists, or especially a lot of the conceptual artists who may have, in a sense, used that same type of tactics to create their own kind of mythologies because so many pieces are missing. I mean, this may not be the best example, but what comes to mind to me that I've always thought about is, I know this is quirky, but it's Chris Burden, who the sculptor mm-hmm. who, you know, is supposedly was crucified to a Volkswagen, you know, nailed through his hand mm-hmm. to the Volkswagen. Now, the picture of him being nailed to the Volkswagen really doesn't show the nails through his hand. And although this is a minor thing, I always wondered, were there really nails through his hand? How could a sculptor yeah. do that, put nails through his own hand? Well, you know, it doesn't seem to be really questioned. As much as I read about it, there's not any evidence for it or against it other than,
yes.
you know, and so we don't know, but it makes it even more, in the context of what you're saying, if I'm understanding that correctly, it makes it that much more fascinating because it's almost impossible to know the answer
exactly.
to that question.
Exactly. But it's important that these artists, they really inspire people. They inspire people to think. There is another example I would like to do about this, and that's, you know, Sperry later in the 80s, he was also teaching as a faculty member, and he was basically, he put together an exhibition idea that was in 77 before he started teaching, was the Musée Sentimental in Paris, and then he reproposed the idea in the 79 with his own students, with his own applied art students in Cologne, 1979. And that exhibition was interesting because basically he asked students, they were mostly from the area, and he said, what do you think are five keywords for Cologne as a city in Germany? What is the characterizing? And so think about those big keywords and choose objects from the city that somehow connect to the world. So it's another challenge the Spirit did, but he did it with the help of, involving a class. And there was a challenge to museum studies, in a way, or the way to create exhibitions. Well, describing the objects methodologically, right, the methodological approach, scientific approach to objects, versus the sentimental approach. It still is notated. These pieces are notated. For instance, you have the football that was used in the final in 1978 of the soccer games. It's there as a relic of something that happened in Cologne. But the idea is let's question the objects with the students of art. Let's question the object. Who gives value to the object? Do the object have intrinsic value, or is it someone like us that give value to the object? So these are all questions that make people think, and he was making his students think. Another interesting aspect of that, if you think at the scholarship of teaching and learning, SOTL, it's something that was defined more specifically by Boyer, Ernst Boyer, in 1990. And we're talking about 1979 with Sperry, that he actually started an experiment that really looks like anticipating SOTL, and he even published that with the students. So that is absolutely remarkable to me. How Sperry told me in an interview, it seemed like I had the GPS. He was able to orient in the art world all the time and be even sometimes, I would argue, in ahead of his time. Really has a nose, like he said, to understand his time.
It's fascinating, right, and to even look ahead of his time. Another thing, though, that the historical perspective, right, to look back or forward on that, it's just fascinating. Sounds like such an interesting project. And, you know, I mean, in closing, I wanted to ask you much more, but it's so nice to stay on this because, you know, we're talking a lot about art history and the game of that, but also, you know, this fascinating artist that you've learned so much more about.
Yes.
Is there any other thing you'd like to tell about writing that book and other stories you came upon? I mean, that seems to be so remarkable, his relationship to concrete poetry, and all
yes.
these other things, and you've told wonderful stories, but it makes me want to hear one more. Is there an example that you read that surprised you, that you didn't think you would come upon, or something that was particularly unusual?
Oh, there's so many things that are unusual about him, and one of them is how this, let's go back to the Musée Sentimental, right, the project that he did, the second Musée Sentimental he did with the students, but the first one, 1977, that prompted the reflection, happened at the Centre Georges Pompidou that was just founded by Pontus Sultan, with the name of Boeck, he actually exhibited in the first edition MAT. So just to tell you, these names recur, right? These people are friends that come back in his life, right? He meets them in different contexts. And so he had this exhibition of the Musée Sentimental at the Centre Pompidou, and there he had different objects like the real bed where he got that, he borrowed that, where Van Gogh died, So he had that among the things he had, and then all palettes from different impressionist artists, and then he also exhibited what arguably were the keys of the Bastille. Now, the interesting fact is that the exhibition was done with Spury in collaboration with an art historian, Marie-Louise von Plessen. So it's art and art history crossing boundaries here. And what happened is during the exhibition, they realized the keys to La Bastille were stolen. So they were really in panic, and they went to the director of Musée Carnavaret that basically lent the keys. And they say, we're in anguish. Those keys are stolen. And he laughed at them. And he said, you know how many keys we have here? Who knows if those are the real ones? So the story basically was, it's amazing, right? So the mystifying these things, and the story, that is, I believe, that is something that made him think about, well, there was a chance product, like pretty much everything that happened in Spury work is chance situations. But basically, is the chance of something that happened that made him think about, probably, arguably, the idea of the who gives value to the object. Are these keys of La Bastille, are they the real ones? Do they have legitimacy or not? Or does it really matter? The important is the sentimental value. They're a relic. They remind us of a period of history, and that's enough. So that also crosses between borders between history and poetry that I find very interesting.
Absolutely. That's absolutely fascinating. Lida, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure, Breiner. Thank you for having me in your program. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.